Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Life is a Story We Tell Ourselves. Today, our guests are conservation biologist Jim Tolisano and his daughter, Coral. Together, they have shared adventures all over the globe, from the Jane Goodall Institute in West Africa to the remote forests of Papua New Guinea, to coming face-to-face with lowland gorillas. Jim, Coral, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And it's good to meet you for the first time, Coral. I understand you've been on some recent adventures. Is that right?
Yes, I was just in New England for a few weeks, exploring, seeing some whales, just getting out there.
Oh, that's good. Well, Jim, I have a very simple question for you to kick this off. So tell me, what does a conservation biologist do?
Well, ostensibly a conservation biologist is someone whose passion is protecting nature and keeping natural places and everything in nature intact, healthy, and still with us. That would be a kind of a simple and maybe a prosaic way of saying it. I think from a more scientific perspective, you could say that conservation biology involves protecting nature and natural systems and everything that supports nature continuing. Maybe the simplest way to say it is conservation biologists love life and everything alive. And we want to keep it all here for all time.
So for you, when you're out in the field as a conservation biologist, what's the kind of thing that you do out in the field as a conservation biologist? I mean, do you do surveys or take census of animals or, you know, sit in the forest and listen to birds and try to identify them?
So I think the easiest way to answer that, Don, is that the answer is yes, but the answer is yes to just about anything you say, because this is where conservation biology gets a little strange. First of all, the biology confuses things, because conservation biology is about people as much as it's about wild animals, trees, forests, rivers, streams, oceans, and everything else on Earth. So a really good conservation biologist is also a really good social scientist if they're doing their job well, because it's very much about people and their relationship to nature and how well that relationship is working.
But you were just mentioning the people aspect of it, and the nexus of people with the natural world, I would imagine, is one of the most important things that you do, and getting people to understand their relationship with the natural world.
Yeah, and I think I came at this in a way that was very helpful to me in this work that I do, but it's kind of an unusual way, I think, for people to come into this work, my undergraduate studies and focus and interest was actually more in the social sciences and even the arts. And I later translated that into work that I was doing in natural resources and national parks and things like that. And then I went to graduate school where I studied conservation science and conservation biology. But interestingly, in graduate school, where I was really strengthening my scientific skills and picking up all those scientific capabilities that I hadn't really paid that much attention to, nobody was talking about people in graduate school. And I just felt fortunate that I had already covered that in my undergraduate. And then I'm out in the world trying to deal with problems around disappearing species, disappearing habitats, degraded ecosystems, and realizing these are social problems. It's not like the ecosystem is degrading itself. It's not like the species is eliminating itself. These are social problems, and they're very much about people and how people live in and relate to nature and the world around them. So
that, Jim, must have led to what I understood to be, certainly in my career, as we worked with various communities and people around the world as they interface with the environment. It led to something that we called community-based conservation. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine as a conservation biologist, you must have had to do a lot of community-based conservation as well. That is involving the community in efforts to conserve the natural world.
Yes, that pretty much became the entire focus of my work. But that wasn't the way it started out originally. Mm-hmm. When I first started doing this work, my work was very much focused on wildlife management, wildlife conservation. And you were talking about this before. Yeah, I was out in the field. We did surveys. We monitored different species. The first thing I ever studied was the wolverine. Nobody wanted to chase that crazy wild weasel around, but I did. And so we were doing surveys of wolverines. Where are they? How many of them are they? What do they like to eat? Where do they go? Mm-hmm. And I moved on. I did research on grizzly bears after that. I worked with the recovery of the Mexican wolf. I started to see a pattern. Like most males, I was particularly interested in large mammals that can eat you. And then I started to realize, you know, the wolverine knows what it's doing. The grizzly bear knows what it's doing. The wolf has a pretty good idea of what it's doing. That's not where the problem is. And I realized, oh, I need to be talking to people and looking at people and working with people and working with communities. So that wasn't immediate. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, at least, you know, we're going back a few years, it wasn't being emphasized enough in the education we were being given.
So it was an evolutionary process as you were doing the work. And it certainly was that way in my field in parks, whether it was national or state parks. Your daughter, Coral, is here. Now, Coral, you must have gone on some of these adventures with your father. I know particularly as we've talked over the years, he mentioned spending time in Italy, of all places, studying wolves. And I think he mentioned that you went on one of those trips with him.
Yes. When I was a teen, actually, we did two summers. I was 14 and 15. And he was there doing actually classes on culture and nature. And I joined him. We ended up doing some solo trips and then working with a friend of his who's a wolf biologist, and had a really unique experience where we got to go down to southern Italy and visit the project and actually witness them coming in.
Let's give him a little more credit. The friend she's talking about is Dr. Luigi Boitani, who is not a wolf biologist. He's the wolf biologist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's amazing. And so what was that like for you?
It was an amazing, unique experience. I've been traveling with my dad since before I can remember. So wildlife and crazy adventures and crazy places was not atypical for us, although that was a really unique experience. We also did a motorcycle trip up and down each coast. So we got a lot of hilarious one-on-one time, which sort of culminated in southern Italy. We had an experience where we were sitting in a Jeep late at night, tracking them with radio collar and
tracking wolves.
And it was just this amazing experience of pure quiet. And we're sitting there listening to the beep, 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 looking at little flashes on a screen, and then get to see them all swoop in at once. Suddenly they're all around us, and it's beep, 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 beep. And it's this like amazing, tense, electric moment where you can feel that they're just outside the Jeep, and then poof, gone. Beep, beep, beep.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I had a similar experience in the jungles of Gabon. Mm-hmm. I was trapped in a rainstorm sitting under a tree. I don't know what had happened to our rangers and our guides, but I was left alone sitting under this tree in a rainstorm, and a troop of chimpanzee swooped in. They were in the trees, and it was just like a wave of, I guess you would say, of animal humanity sweeping over me in the trees, and then poof, they were gone.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there shivering and shaking and praying that those chimpanzees would stay in,
you know,
in the trees. These were not zoo or circus chimpanzees.
Don, that may be why your guides were gone.
It probably was why the guards were gone. Oh, my goodness. What an experience that was. So I know exactly what you must have felt like, your Jeep surrounded by wolves. Like that. But, you know, you were talking about people, and Jim, that brings to mind something else you've told me in the past, that you've worked in some fairly dangerous situations with both animals and people and people in environment. So what was your scariest experience? Was it animals or people? I know at one time you were even held hostage somewhere, weren't you?
If you want a story of running into people in a situation that may not have been the best, you know, time and place to be there. I was with some colleagues, and we were doing survey work to delineate some new protected areas. And this was on the border of Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And this goes back a few years when things were kind of unsettled in Nicaragua. And there were all kinds of folks wandering around out in the remote areas thinking they were going to take over the Nicaraguan government. Of course, as I say this, I think that's actually true today, too. Mm-hmm. So my friends and I were working in Costa Rica, and we were following different rivers and going through different mountainous areas. And then at one point, one of my friends, who happened to live in Costa Rica, looked at a map and went, "You know, I don't think we're in Costa Rica anymore. I think we're in Nicaragua." And we went, "This isn't good, because we just crossed a border we shouldn't have crossed." And so we started to make our way back, and out of the forest came this ragtag band of guys, you know, sort of with army uniforms, but it was only part of a uniform. They definitely had some impressive weapons with them, though. And conversation started up in Spanish, and they were asking, "So what are you doing out here?" We weren't quite sure what to say. Since we were working on a project being funded by the U.S. State Department, we knew we didn't want to talk about that.
Right.
So one of my friends went, we're looking at birds. We're studying birds. And they went, "Why?" "Well, we're just biologists. We're researching birds." So they weren't quite sure what to do with us. They figured, let's just hold them hostage. They may be worth something. We sat there for a while they tried to figure out what they wanted to do with us. And I just had an idea. I reached towards my pack, started to reach in it. All the guns came up.
Oh, my goodness.
And I went, wait, nothing. Just getting one thing from my pack. And I pulled out a bag of chocolate chip cookies. Who doesn't like chocolate chip cookies? And I just went, "Galletas? Cookies?" And they looked at each other and went, "Sure." So we started passing around the cookies, and while we're eating the cookies, one of them went, "You know, we've seen some interesting birds. What kind of birds are you interested in?" My friend immediately took out his notebook, and as they described birds they'd seen, he wrote them down as if it was important. And we ate all the cookies. They told us about more birds. And they went, "You guys seem okay. You can go on your way." And we ran like hell. So, I got a few moments like that. Sure.
That's great. You know, the other thing that's that interests me about being a conservation biologist, and, of course, I've heard many stories from my daughter, who you mentored for years, as she worked in areas in Africa. But I'm wondering, with both you and Coral, what experiences have you had that, I don't know, you would consider either the most memorable, or something happened to you as you're out there in the wilds together that that you just can't forget?
Chimps. Chimps.
Chimps.
Once again, the chimps.
Go. The chimps.
I was joining my father in Tanzania. He was working for the Jane Goodall Institute, and sort of as a happy twist of fate, I was going through a phase of reading all her books and reading a bunch of books by Franz Dual, and I got it in my mind that we had to go to Gombe and I had to meet these fantastic chimps that I've been reading about. So it falls into place and we get to go there, and we're going out with a guide, and it's a fantastic young kid who's taking us along the trail, and we get really lucky and come across a troop, and he can see that we're making smart choices and we're excited about being there, and allows us to go off trail. So leads us off into the woods. And there's this amazing moment where we're walking through this dense brush looking for them. And I look to the side, and like less than a foot from my face, there are chimps just right beyond the foliage, right next to me, looking at me. And we've walked right into their troop and they're sitting. And it's this kind of beautiful, amazing moment where I'm feeling connected and the oneness of the earth. And then everything shifts as a male enters and charges us.
Not just any male.
Yeah, it was Frodo, who has a penchant for dismemberment, as it is.
He's killed at least one person.
Yes. And I was on the front of the group. So my father and the guide were behind me and managed to back up, and I couldn't. And I got full charge right into my face, and he stood and looked right into my eyes. And that was a terrifying moment of, it shifted from like, oh, the oneness of nature, to I could easily have my arms ripped off and there's absolutely nothing I can do.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you tell that story, because we tend to romanticize nature, particularly chimpanzees. And even if you watch a documentary, a Jane Goodall documentary, even though she tries her best to be scientific and tell a thorough story of chimps and their lives, you still come away with somewhat of a romanticized notion of what nature is like sometime. And your experience, though, was one of reality. So even though sometimes you're out there studying and you have these wonderful moments of feeling one with nature, there is real and imminent, you know, danger out there as well.
Absolutely. I mean, moments after this, we also saw them hunt and rip apart monkeys.
Well, that's what saved you, actually.
Yeah.
Was because Coral is staring into the face of this. He's the alpha male of this troop, and he's got a bad attitude and a bad reputation. And she says, what do I do now? And what? There's nothing you can do. It's totally up to him. And then they heard some blue monkeys off in the distance, which are these smaller primates that they like to eat. And when they heard those other smaller primates, they all got lit up. It was sort of like they heard an ice cream truck. And they were no longer interested in us. So they took off to go get dinner. And we were fortunate enough. We said, okay, cool, let's follow them. But it eliminated that danger. Had that not happened, I don't know.
I don't know either.
It was
a tense moment.
Yeah.
Although in chasing them, I had been hoping to see a black mamba and was chasing them downhill into a black mamba, which was another interesting surprise.
Yeah, probably. That was pretty scary.
Yeah, that was, I think, arguably more terrifying for my father.
Oh, hell yes.
I wasn't scared, although I should have been. I stopped and watched it cross. And then I said, Dad, there's a black mamba. And he came sprinting afterwards, slipped in chimpanzee bile and waste, bashing his head open in an effort to try and get to me to get away from it. And I just stood there and it just crossed in front of me.
It was a moment where I was wondering about my own parenting skills. Coral's excited to see a black mamba.
It was like 6 feet long. It was really beautiful.
I'm terrified.
And for those that we're talking about a snake here, and most people don't, some of our listeners will know what you're talking about.
We're talking about a very aggressive, territorial snake that is also a neurotoxin. If that snake bites you, how fast can you write a will?
Yeah.
Because that's what you've got.
It was actually the guide we were with was standing next to me when it happened, and he he stood there and we sort of silently let it cross. And then he turns to me and he smiles and he goes, ah, there are only ever two outcomes. One is death. The other is luck. Today we are lucky.
Oh my goodness. The next thing I want to talk about a little bit about is climate change. You're a conservation biologist. You're out there in the environment all of the time. We're always hearing lots of different things about the effects of climate change on the environment. So I want to ask you a little bit about the intersection of your work with climate change. So what have you noticed out there in the field with respect to conservation and climate change?
Well, a lot of what we're anticipating and we're actually worried that was going to happen does in fact seem to be happening. So I first encountered climate change as sort of a really powerful concept when I was in graduate school. That goes back quite a ways. Mm-hmm. And I took a class called bioclimatology. So that's looking at the climate near the ground as it affects all living things. In that class, my professor, who was kind of a young, hip guy, said, hey, let's play with some models to see what we can do to screw up the climate. And so we did. And we would change the concentration of carbon and other greenhouse gases and see what kind of effects it would have. And one of the things that became really obvious was you could produce all kinds of results, but you would definitely produce results. Things would definitely change. And that was the point when I realized that what we were doing as a society, as a civilization, adding all of these different gases, adding carbon and methane and other gases to the atmosphere, was definitely going to have an impact. What was going to be really difficult to nail down was, what exactly will that impact be? And I started to worry, oh no, we're basically turning our relationship to nature and to the world's climate into Las Vegas. Hmm. We're just making this all kind of a random surprise. And that's what I think scares me the most. Yes, some of the things that we've anticipated, greater temperature extremes, more intense storms, water seeping into the streets of Miami, these things are happening. I'm noticing things such as even where I live now, flowers showing up earlier in the year or at different times of the year, migrating birds coming earlier, leaving sooner. I'm noticing changes like that. But the magnitude of all of this, how it's all going to play out, I don't really know. And that's probably the scariest part to me. What will it mean for species over the long term? I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure anyone could predict it. We can see some things that are happening. Some species do better. Some do worse. That's true for plants, for trees, for things that we call weeds. Some do better. Some things that we really like do worse. Some species, we're seeing more of them. They may not be the species we like. Some species that we love, we see less of them.
Like the polar bear.
Yeah, this is not a good time to be a polar bear.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work out well for them. This probably is not a good time to be a grizzly bear. We are kind of noticing a pattern in that if you're a very large species, a grizzly bear, a whale, this is tougher on you because the changes are big, they're broad, and they sometimes are very sweeping, and it just may not work out for you. So my biggest worry when I think about climate change is I don't entirely know how this is going to play out. But will it have an effect? Absolutely. You know, because of what we're contributing and throwing into the environment, there's no way it could not have an effect. But if you want me to tell you exactly what that effect is going to be, I don't exactly know.
You know, when I've talked to people about climate change before, even on this program, it often segues into a discussion about pollution in general. And they say, while we're talking about climate change, which will have these long-term impacts, we're ignoring one of the major problems in the environment. And I think, you know, recently I had an environmental journalist on the program, Paul Rogers, and his biggest concern was plastics in the environment. And you can see from the microplastics that are now major problems in the ocean to just the tonnage and that's in the ocean right now in particular, not to mention in landfills that won't degrade for perhaps hundreds of years. So as a conservation biologist, you're out there working with animals and ecosystems. You know, what's the impact of, you know, pollution in general and particularly plastics that you've seen?
Well, it's, you know, a lot of what when conservation biologists look at a problem, they're often looking at all the different species and life forms that you find in a particular place in an ecosystem and the different factors that will affect them. And things that really jump out are, do these species have the habitat they need to survive? Do they have the food? Do they have the cover, the ability to reproduce, have families, live out their lives? Do they have everything they need? And pollution is just another way that we're degrading or damaging these habitats. In this case, of course, we should remember that we're part of that ecosystem too. So we need habitat too. We sometimes may overlook it, but even if you walk outside in Manhattan, you're pretty dependent on having an atmosphere you can breathe. Mm-hmm. You're pretty dependent on having a world, even a natural world, that's going to support you, that's going to give you food, and that's going to give you what you need. And when you talk about things like plastics and microplastics and a crazy, chaotic climate, you're disrupting that habitat. You're disrupting everything we need and every other species needs to continue to be. Mm-hmm. So that's where it really worries me.
I understand. And, you know, the solution to these problems for someone like you that's a conservation biologist must seem elusive sometime. I mean, do you feel sometimes that, you know, there are no solutions or that it's one step forward and two steps backwards?
Depends on the part of the day. There certainly are moments during the day where I go, hey, this could possibly work. And then there are others where I just think about climbing into my closet and sealing myself off. These are really complicated problems. It's a very scary window to look through at times. However, I think there are solutions. I think there are things that we have done that have produced some pretty exciting results. I think the problem is we just don't do enough of them. And we don't do them at the scale where we're having the kind of change that we need, the magnitude of change that we need to see.
I understand. So let's switch reels here for a minute. The other thing I'm interested in, for me, the environment has been, you know, always a mystical and spiritual place. I mean, I'm here in the Andes because for some reason as a young man, I became fascinated with mountains and the Andes in particular, and always wanted to live in the Andes, never dreamed that I would. But the reason being is one that's not easily explained. And so I'm wondering, both of you, Coral and Jim, in your experiences in the environment, have you had one of those mystical experiences or transcendent experiences where you came out of it looking at the world totally different than before?
One?
One, many, several?
Many.
No, go ahead.
Well, first I'll say, Don, if you're in the Andes and you're not having regular spiritual experiences, then you're not paying attention. Yeah, that's a very profound place. And that's certainly a place where I think we've even shared some of that. So a few years ago, I was working on a project in northeastern Peru where Coral, once again, came. She was helping me with this project. And it was working with rural communities that live outside of a very large, remote national park called Cordillera Azul, the Blue Mountains National Park. And we were looking at ways to engage those communities more in the conservation of that area. Very remote, impossible area to get into. Great fun. But since we happened to be there, Coral said, Dad, we might as well go to Machu Picchu. So we did. And we ended up walking up to Machu Picchu in the dark so that we could be there and experience it at dawn. And that's a very amazing, profound, otherworldly experience where the sun's coming up and you're looking at how it aligns with the buildings that have been left behind by the Incan people who lived there and the way the light cascades off those mountains and into your eyes and into your body and your soul. And you just start experiencing things a little differently. And it's one of those moments where if you're really good to yourself, you don't say anything. Mm-hmm. Just let it happen.
What was that like for you, Coral? I mean, what did you come away with feeling?
A lot of things. I was working through a difficult time in my life, and actually why we chose to do that. I was struggling with sort of feeling lost and dealing with some depression. And it was actually my dad who said, why don't you make a bucket list and let's talk about what it is that you really want to do and really want to see in this life. And on the top three of my list was, I want to see Machu Picchu at dawn. And then it lined up that this project worked out and we could go there and do that together. And as a secondary thing, some 30 years apart, but at the same ages in our lives, my dad had been touched by the same book as me. We're reading poems by Pablo Neruda. And it just, I needed to go there and I needed to feel that. And he understood. So being able to share the same poetry in the same moment with the same dream with my dad was really important to me. We birdwatched together and have since I was young. So being able to birdwatch as the sun came up and sort of fulfill something that I felt that I needed to feel complete helped me work through a lot of that. Sort of gave me that sense of completion and release and renewed energy to take the next steps in my life.
And that was just with the being there in that place and, in national parks and in state parks and in many places where we interpret the environment, we talk about a sense of place or a place having a spirit unto itself that you can connect with. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about. You got in touch with that sense of place or the spirit of that place.
It was like a depth. It was a depth and a vastness that I felt like I could pour in all this big, confusing darkness. I could give it to that place and sort of feel free of it. And at the same time, get to share
a unique experience with my dad where we could connect sort of across time to when he had been my age and wanted the same thing.
Yeah, those connections are so important. And when you can feel like that, I was talking with your dad also about the, and the way I describe it is getting up in the middle of the night and having, and being overcome with this tremendous sense of wonder. And at the same time, almost smallness in existing in a vastness that you don't understand. And for me, I end up saying to myself, is this real? Or my favorite word to myself is, how can this possibly be?
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
So I understand what you mean.
Those are the moments that we live for.
Right. And I have them often, which I think I'm blessed to have them often. I didn't think they pour out of a sense of gratitude and gratefulness. It instills this tremendous sense of gratitude about being alive. And I think when you're standing somewhere at dawn at Machu Picchu, and you're in that vastness and in that stillness, you have a realization of how unique and miraculous life is. And it's an experience I think that everyone should have. And that's how important the natural world and the real world is, and why I wanted to have you on this program as a conservation biologist and your experience, not just to talk about the raw biology, but what happens to us as human beings when we interact with the natural world.
The other thing that I remember thinking about when we were at Machu Picchu was that, you know, I was there, and that it's obviously a very special place, and it generates lots of feelings just because of what you can see and what you feel at that elevation. But I realized that now goes back thousands of years, really. A place where, you know, you're at a high elevation, that elevation makes you feel certain things. You are looking across what feels like just an endless series of immense peaks and the power that you feel from those mountains. And you realize that you're in such a profound and unique natural area, but that experience has been felt by people for thousands of years, that you now are part of that continuity. And that's part of the spiritual impact that I felt there, that I'm getting to share this experience that actually drove these people to drag themselves and all this rock and other things up to this point so that they could feel that all the time, so that they could live there and feel that. And I'm getting to experience that as well. I'm part of that continuity.
Well, Jim, is there one final thought you want to leave for our listeners as a conservation biologist? Out of all your experiences and everything you've done in the environment and traveling all over the world, if you could communicate one thought to people about what you've learned through your experience as a conservation biologist out there in the world, what would it be?
Well, like I said, I started out this journey thinking that I was going to find a way to enjoy a life lived outside with wild nature and wild animals, and in the process help keep some of that nature around for the next generation. That's certainly, you know, what I was thinking as a young person. I'm going to help protect nature. And in the process, I have discovered that about 20% of this work is indeed good biological science. Getting to know the world around us, yes, going out, studying wildlife, recording the data on wildlife, understanding the habitat, that's a good 20% of it. About 70% of it is social work. It's working with people who live in nature, and it's helping all of us develop a relationship that's very mutual and mutually supportive. I would say that for way too many right now, the relationship between people and nature is something that I'd probably call as abusive. If I were a counselor, I'd say this looks a bit like an abusive relationship to me. I think we need to change a few things here. I think we need to start shifting how we look at everything around us, the world we live in, and start looking for ways to make that much more mutually supportive for all of us, much more of a give as well as a take. I think that's just as true if you happen to live on the side of a mountain in Montana as if you live in the Bronx. You are still in a relationship with other people and other life on this planet. I have to make that a much more respectful, mutually supportive relationship. By the way, I said about 20% science, about 70% social work. The other 10% is just celebrating it. It's figuring out what the story of your relationship with nature is and finding a way to celebrate that and tell it. So that's where the arts come in. So you want to be a really good conservation biologist? Well, get your scientists together and be a good scientist. Do science well. Build up your social and your communication skills. Let your inner artist out. If you can do all three of those things, then you're going to be a great conservation biologist and you're really going to give something back. That's what I think it takes. That's what seems to work for me.
That's a wonderful thought to leave our listeners with, Jim. Jim Coral, thank you so much for being on the program. I just absolutely loved having you on the program and getting to know you as well, Coral.
Thank you for having us.
What a delight. Thanks so much for inviting us. And thanks for sharing what you do with everyone out there.
And now a sonnet by Pablo Neruda. This is sonnet number 6 from 100 Love Sonnets. I chose this sonnet because it reveals the deep connections we have with nature. I snapped off a dark branch and lifted its murmur and thirst to my lips. Perhaps the weeping voice of the rain, a shattered bell, or a broken heart. It came to me, something out of far distance, deeply concealed and hidden by earth, a cry defeated by immense autumns, by half-opened moistness of shadowy leaves. But waking out of the woods dream there, that hazel branch sang under my tongue, and its vagrant perfume rose to my mind as if suddenly roots I had long abandoned searched me, the lost domains of childhood, and held me, wounded by wandering fragrance. Well, thank you all for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Life is a Story We Tell Ourselves. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and go to lifeisastorypodcast.com and hit that like button. Stay safe, share happiness, and remember the important thing is to never stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing.